It's time now to begin the reading of today's Boston Herald on the Talking Information Center. It's Tuesday, the 18th of August, 2026. With the Boston Herald, we say hello to Claire.
Good morning, everyone. We're glad you're with us. We'll start off with an article entitled, DA Says Good Samaritan Stopped Attack. Prosecutors say woman intervened in vicious stabbing. This is written by Gayla Cawley. Prosecutors said the man who allegedly stabbed his girlfriend repeatedly last week near North Station only stopped the attack because he was pulled off the victim by a Good Samaritan. Suffolk County District Attorney Kevin Hayden's office released more details on the double stabbing that occurred late last Thursday morning, where a man, Dowdy Martinez, age 51, is accused of stabbing his 44-year-old girlfriend multiple times before stabbing himself to the point where he sustained life-threatening injuries. Prosecutors outlined the gory details of the broad daylight domestic violence that occurred in the area of 44 Causeway Street during a Boston Municipal Court arraignment that was held Monday via Zoom from Martinez's hospital bed. Martinez is facing one count of armed assault to murder, four counts of assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, one count of assault and battery on a family or household member, subsequent offense, and one count of assault and battery on a family or household member, according to the DA's office. Prosecutors said police responded to a report of a stabbing in progress last Thursday and found the female victim screaming in Spanish, with blood running down her face from a head wound and on the back of her leg. The woman told police she had gotten into a fight with her boyfriend, who, quote, pushed her to the ground and proceeded to stab her at least four times, unquote. Police then observed that she had stab wounds on her forehead, left hand, chin, and neck, and behind her left leg, prosecutor said. A prosecutor said, quote, the police were able to recover some video from the scene where the defendant can be seen attacking the victim and stabbing her multiple times. The defendant doesn't stop until an unidentified female comes up behind him and pulls him off the victim, end quote. The woman was taken to Mass General Hospital for treatment. When police responded to the scene, they were directed to go inside an unidentified restaurant where Martinez was allegedly, quote, wielding a knife, end quote. Quote, when the police approached him, he began stabbing himself and slashing his own neck, end quote, a prosecutor said of Martinez, and went on, quote, he dropped the knife when police threatened to deploy their tasers on him, end quote. Prosecutors said Martinez was taken to the hospital with life-threatening injuries. The victim is, quote, recovering from her injuries, end quote, the prosecution added. Martinez was previously convicted for assault and battery on a family or household member out of West Roxbury Municipal Court, prosecutors said. He was held without bail pending a dangerousness hearing set for Wednesday. And now we'll move on to an article entitled, Police Probe Fatal Stabbing. This comes out of Dorchester and is also written by Gayla Cawley. A man was stabbed to death in Dorchester early Monday morning, police said. Boston police responded to a report of a person stabbed in the area of Wilbert Road and Harvard Street at about 3:20 a.m. and found a man suffering from stab wounds upon arrival. The man was taken to a local hospital where he was pronounced dead, police said. The incident is under investigation by the police department's homicide unit. No arrests have been made, and the victim has not been identified. Police are urging anyone with information about the stabbing to contact the homicide unit at 617-343-4470. That's 617-343-4470. Anonymous tips can also be shared via the Crime Stoppers tip line at 1-800-494-TIPS or by sent by texting the word, in quotes, TIP to crime, C-R-I-M-E, and that is 27463, police said. The incident comes soon after back-to-back stabbings that occurred last week between Wednesday night and Thursday morning at and within steps of two of the city's busiest MBTA stations, respectively. Two people were stabbed near North Station and TD Garden late Thursday morning in what police believe to be an act of domestic violence, where a man stabbed a woman and then himself, and I'll pitch in and say that's the article I just read. The night before, a man was stabbed to death at South Station after a fight on an escalator. Police on Monday identified the South Station victim as Latavius Owens, age 29, of Memphis, Tennessee. Okay, and now we're going to go on to an article regarding Lindsey Clancy's trial. It's subheaded Duxbury Horror, and it's entitled, in quotes, "I'm really sick. Something is wrong," end quote. Lindsey Clancy's mom takes the stand, and the prosecution rests. Colleen Cronin writes this article. Lindsey Clancy's mother took the stand Monday to testify about what her daughter was like before and in the lead-up to the death of her grandchildren. Paula Musgrove described her daughter as a good kid, an excellent student, who became, quote, "a loving mother, a fun mother," end quote. Musgrove told the jury, quote, "I always thought it was the best thing that ever happened to her. She would do anything for her children," end quote. Clancy is accused of murdering her three children, Cora, age 5, Dawson, age 3, and Callan, 8 months, on January 24, 2023. Musgrove became emotional talking about them. Musgrove said, telling the jury that being a grandmother, quote, "It was the most beautiful thing. I love my grandchildren with all my heart," end quote. Clancy sat in the courtroom crying. Her mother was one of the first witnesses called by the defense after the prosecution rested its case on Monday. The defendant's attorney, Kevin Reddington, asked Musgrove when she first noticed that something was wrong with her daughter's mental health. Musgrove, who was living in Connecticut at the time, said that she started to notice Clancy was off sometime in October. Callan, the baby, was having trouble taking a bottle, and Clancy was worried about returning to work. Then Musgrove got a concerning text on October the 20th, 2022. It said, quote, "Mom, will you please come up and stay with me for a bit? I'm really sick. Something is wrong," end quote. Musgrove read the text out loud to the jury. Clancy told her mother that she'd started a medication and felt it was making things worse. Quote, "It's just really scary, and I don't want to be alone," end quote, the text said. Musgrove testified that she drove to Duxbury, where the Clancy family lived, that day. Over the next few months, Clancy appeared to get worse. Musgrove and her husband visited often. Clancy's husband Patrick's family was often there when they were. Quote, "Through November into December, it was not getting better, and into the holidays," end quote, she said. At one point, Clancy told her mother she was so scared of being alone, of not sleeping, that she asked to sleep with her. In early December, Musgrove said she remembered standing in the kitchen with Clancy and her husband Patrick. Quote, "I remember her being very nervous. She said, 'I just have to tell you guys something,'" end quote. "And then she told us," Musgrove said. She and went on, "She told us that she had thoughts of harming the children." Clancy's then-husband asked if she felt like she couldn't be alone with the kids, and Clancy said no. The defendant would go to the emergency room twice that month and be admitted to McLean Hospital during New Year's for an inpatient program. In January, Musgrove said that Clancy had lost significant weight and stopped wanting to drive. Quote, "She had become, during this whole time, paranoid about different things that really weren't logical. She would mention that this wasn't her mind, end quote, Musgrove said, and went on, quote, she was attempting to go through the motions of her day, end quote. On cross-examination, Plymouth County Assistant District Attorney Jennifer Sprague asked Musgrove about messages with Clancy where the defendant appeared to report that she was feeling slightly better in January. In one mid-January text to Musgrove, Clancy wrote that she was feeling better than she had weeks before as she tapered off the drug Seroquel. The prosecutor also asked if Musgrove recalled her conversation with the police the day after the killings and that she told them that Clancy seemed better right before the children were killed. Quote, I remember speaking to the police. I had just found out what happened. I was pretty much in shock, end quote, Musgrove said. Before the Commonwealth rested, prosecutors called Ian Whiffen, an employee of Cellebrite, the company that analyzed Clancy's phone. Whiffen, who also presented testimony at Karen Reed's trial last year, said that Clancy's phone data showed that she'd walked two flights of stairs within a five-minute period from 5:33 p.m. and 5:38 p.m. on the night of the killings, the last two such motions tracked by her devices. During the same period, she had missed a call from Patrick Clancy and called him back, with the conversation lasting 14 seconds. In their opening, the prosecution said that Clancy called her husband back after killing the children and before trying to kill herself, and that she appeared normal on the phone, but in the middle of something. Clancy isn't disputing that she did the killings. Instead, Reddington is arguing that she was suffering from postpartum psychosis at the time, something the Commonwealth has been trying to undermine in their own arguments. Whiffen did add the caveat that some activities, including driving a car uphill, can mistakenly identify a flight of stairs climbed. On cross-examination, Reddington asked about the accuracy of Cellebrite data and the fact that Clancy's devices registered movement on January 25, 2023, while the defendant was in a coma. The trial will resume Tuesday morning. And that's this morning, folks. And that is the end of that article. We'll now go on to a political article entitled Poll Finds Markey Lead Growing Over Moulton. This comes under the subheading of the Senate race and says, in the latest sampling, 60% of Dems and Independents back the incumbent. Grace Zuckovich has written this article. A new poll on the Massachusetts U.S. Senate race finds incumbent Senator Ed Markey leading U.S. Representative Seth Moulton by nearly 30 points in the month ahead of the September 1st primary. The poll, conducted by UMass Amherst / WCVB, using 445 self-identified Democratic primary voters between August 5th and 12th, found 60% of Democrats and Independents polled reported they would vote for Markey at the time. Of those polled, 32% reported they would select Moulton. The results represent an uptick in Markey's lead from October 25th UMass polling, when 51% polled responded Markey and 28% said Moulton. Similarly, 66% of Democrat and Independent respondents indicated they trusted Markey, quote, more to represent you on the issues you care about, end quote, compared to Moulton's 34%. Quote, the largest theme among Markey supporters is Markey's progressivism, which supporters prefer to Moulton's perceived moderation, end quote, the poll states. The poll notes Markey supporters' praise of his standing for, quote, ordinary people, end quote, over special interests, long tenure as an asset, and, quote, strong support, end quote, for transgender people. The top theme among Moulton supporters, the poll found, was his status as a younger candidate. Quote, respondents in this theme argue that because Moulton is younger, he has a better grasp of contemporary problems and a more current view of society, end quote, UMass stated, noting responses also characterizing Markey's long tenure as a negative. Moulton as a more moderate choice, the candidate's willingness to depart from the party on trans athletes, and his military service. Asked about the candidate's, quote, top three qualities determining their vote, the majority of respondents, 24%, selected, quote, best represents my views on the issues, end quote, as their top quality in the most recent polling. Last October, 31% selected, quote, will challenge President Trump, end quote, as their first, down to 19% in August. Respondents also ranked Markey higher in supporting almost every demographic ground listed, including large leads in seniors, LGBTQ people, and immigrants. Moulton held a slight lead for representing young people. The poll also looks forward to the general election, finding Markey with a 51% lead over Republican candidate John Deaton's 30%, and Moulton similarly at 49% over Deaton's 25%. Pollsters even look further ahead to the 2032 election, when Markey has stated he will not be running. Top potential candidates, the poll found, included Moulton, Governor Maura Healey, and U.S. Representative Ayanna Pressley, followed by options like former Representative Joseph Kennedy III, Mayor Michelle Wu, and Representative Jake Auchincloss. Markey and Moulton are scheduled to meet for a final debate before the September primary on Thursday from 8 to 9 p.m. on WCVB, in partnership with WBUR and the Boston Globe. The live, televised debate, moderated by WCVB anchor Ed Harding, will be live-streamed on WCVB.com, WBUR.org, and Globe.com, and broadcast live on WBUR 90.9 FM. That's the end of that article, and I'm going to take a sip of water. And the next article is entitled, DOJ Rule Allows Some Felons to Get Guns Back. It's under the subheading of Second Amendment, and it's written by Alana Durkin-Richer from the Associated Press. Washington. The Justice Department finalized a rule Monday that will pave the way for people who've been barred from owning firearms because of criminal convictions to apply to have their gun rights reinstated. The process, launched by newly confirmed Attorney General Todd Blanche, is a victory for Second Amendment advocates who have long pushed for nonviolent people with felony convictions to be given a pathway to regain their legal right to own arms. Firearms. Quote, the Second Amendment is not a second-class right, and the federal government should not permanently deprive Americans of a constitutional right without regard to whether they pose a danger to public safety, end quote, Blanche said in a statement. The Attorney General said the new process will protect, quote, public safety while giving deserving Americans a real path to restoration, end quote. It's the latest move by President Donald Trump's administration to ease firearm restrictions. The Justice Department moved earlier this year to roll back and modify a slate of gun regulations. Separately, the department recently decided against challenging a court ruling that struck down regulations on firearm suppressors and certain guns. Federal law has long allowed people who've had their gun rights stripped because of felony convictions to petition the government for the ability to own firearms again. But Congress, since 1992, has effectively barred the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives from processing applications. The Trump administration's rule aims to circumvent that by establishing a new application system using an online portal. The Justice Department says restoration will be granted on a case-by-case basis, weighing a person's record and reputation to determine whether they pose a likely threat to public safety. Officials say people who have been convicted of violent crimes, registered sex offenders, people living in the country illegally, and others whom officials believe pose a danger to society will be denied, quote, absent extraordinary circumstances, end quote. Chris Brown, the president of Brady, which advocates for stronger gun laws, said her group is still reviewing the administration's final rule, but has stressed the need for a, quote, robust and thoughtful system that minimizes the risk to public safety, end quote. Continued quote, yet the Trump administration has consistently shown us that they have no such discretion, including by restoring gun rights to convicted domestic abusers and violent January 6 insurrectionists, and by tirelessly rolling back broad policies proven to prevent crime and gun violence, Brown said in a statement. That is the end of that article. And hang on one second. We will go on to an opinion. This commentary is written by Joe Battenfeld, and it is entitled Leavitt Departure Signals Change at WH. The abrupt departure of longtime loyal White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt could mean Trump 2.0 is winding down, burdened by the Iran war and the rough economy, and looking to transition to J.D. Vance after the potentially disastrous midterms. The Republican president looks increasingly tired and running out of steam, and has not introduced any major new initiatives, and could see the political writing on the wall. The 80-year-old Trump could even be looking for a way out if Democrats take control of Congress, giving the vice president 2 years to ramp up for 2028. Vance has been playing up to MAGA lately, going hard on immigration and confronting reporters similar to his boss. Quote, that was a doozy, end quote, Vance told a reporter in the White House press room who he criticized for giving a speech masquerading as a question. The vice president has also taken the lead on defending the Trump administration's immigration policies and aggressive use of ICE to deport non-citizens. Trump has kept up an amazing nonstop pace since winning in 2024, but how long can he do that? The midterm results so far show that Trump's power is waning in the Republican Party, with several of his endorsed candidates, like pillow man Mike Lindell, losing badly. The war against Iran, which now seems bogged down, has taken a major toll on the president both politically and personally. Trump is now looking for a way out of the quagmire. Pete Hegseth is a joke and should not be Secretary of War, despite Trump's stubborn insistence that he stay in that important role. Leavitt's surprise departure has triggered speculation about her reasons for leaving, which could include more than just her stated reason of wanting to spend more time with her children. She has a bright future, either as a future candidate for office or a cabinet secretary in a Republican administration. She could also see that the Trump administration is spiraling down, facing a possible long and nasty impeachment process after the midterms. She may have become angered at being left in the decoy Air Force One during the catering truck escapade. Or is it possible she realizes that Vance wants his own person in the White House press office? Just days after Leavitt announced she was quitting, a key Vance person at the White House, Deputy National Security Advisor Andy Baker, said he would be leaving his post in the coming weeks. The departure could mean Trump is shaking up his administration, but more likely they indicate dissatisfaction with the way things are going in the White House. Trump reportedly told supporters a few weeks ago to get behind Vance, but shortly after denied the report and said he wasn't taking sides. Marco Rubio has emerged as a major force in Trump's second term, serving as Secretary of State at a time when the U.S. was at war with Iran and trying to negotiate an end to the Israel-Hamas war. Polls show Republican voters are currently about evenly split over who they would back in 2028, with Vance holding just a small lead over Rubio. That is the end of Joe Battenfeld's opinion for today. We'll now go to an article in coming out of Fall River and entitled Guilty Plea in Brutal Sex Trafficking Case. And it's subheaded Beatings, Threats, Starvation Used to Coerce Victim, Feds Say. Grace Zokovich has written this article for us. A South Carolina man pleaded guilty to sex trafficking charges Monday related to brutal accusations from 2023 of coercing at least one woman into sex work in Fall River through threats, beatings, and torture tactics, the U.S. Department of Justice reported. Quote, this defendant used deplorable means to compel the victim to perform commercial sex acts for the financial benefit of himself and his co-defendants, end quote, said Andrew Tyson Duvet, Assistant Attorney General with the Justice Department's Criminal Division. His conduct was cruel and predatory in multiple ways, which included physical beatings and threatening to separate her from her child, end quote. Alexander Smalls, age 27, of Beaufort, North Carolina, pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit sex trafficking between January and August of 2023, related to a criminal enterprise involving numerous co-defendants, the department stated. Smalls faces a mandatory minimum penalty of 15 years and maximum penalty of life in prison. The defendant was accused of using, quote, physical beatings, threats, intimidation, sleep deprivation, starvation, and other means to coerce at least one adult victim to engage in repeated commercial sex acts in and around Fall River, Massachusetts, between January and August of 2023, end quote, the U.S. Department of Justice stated. In January 2023, Smalls and co-defendant Christy Parker were accused of beginning to coerce and force the victim to engage in the sex acts. The defendants, quote, manufactured debts on the victim, gave and withheld alcohol, causing the victim to experience seizures, and threatened to have the authorities take the victim's minor child away from her, end quote, prosecutors said. The conspiracy continued after Smalls was incarcerated on unrelated charges in March of 2023, as he coordinated from prison until Parker's arrest in August 2023, Justice Department officials stated. Five co-defendants, including Parker, who pleaded guilty, have been convicted. Defendants Tyreek Reed, 22, Corey Primo, 44, Evani Jeffers, 24, and Tracyon Reed, 23, were convicted on various counts, including conspiracy to commit sex trafficking and forced labor, and sentenced up to 70 months in prison. Parker is still awaiting sentencing, the department said. Quote, this case shows the insidious tactics traffickers use, slowly gaining the trust of their victims before brutally betraying them, end quote, said New England ICE Homeland Security Investigations Acting Special Agent in Charge, Jeffrey Grimming. And went on with cases like this, we choose to focus not solely on the cruelty of the perpetrators, but also on the resilience of the survivors. We hope today's plea brings a measure of justice and sense of closure to those Smalls victimized as they continue to heal. Smalls is scheduled to return to court for sentencing on December the 9th. And that is the end of that. And now here's a short article out of Homeland Security entitled, ICE Boston Lashes Back at Wu and Healy. Cites arrest in city of, quote, sick criminal alien, end quote. The Boston Herald staff wrote this. ICE Boston is hitting back at Mayor Michelle Wu's threat to use Freedom of Information laws to spot who may bite on the agency's request for 249 contiguous parking spaces in the city. ERO Boston, the local arm of immigration enforcement, tweeted today that the arrest of an illegal immigrant from Honduras is an example of who they are seeking. Quote, these are the types of sick criminal aliens that Governor Healy and Mayor Wu seek to protect, end quote, ICE tweeted. The Post added that the suspect's criminal history includes, quote, pending charges for statutory rape and prior arrests for rape of a child and indecent assault and battery on a child under 14. ICE was, end quote, ICE was referring to Martin Carias Reyes, a criminal illegal immigrant living in Boston. The agency also listed recent arrests of illegal immigrants in Everett, Waltham, Framingham, Worcester, Rhode Island, and Maine. As the Herald is reporting, Wu plans to try to prevent immigration enforcement officers from parking in Boston by attempting to figure out who wants to lease spaces to them. That is the end of that. And we will go on now. I want to find at 10:30, if you bear with me just a second, the opinion pages for today. Hang on. Here we go. The editorial is headed Kevin Hayden for DA. Suffolk County needs a district attorney who won't play politics. With all the crime in the city, Boston deserves someone who takes the job seriously. That person is incumbent DA Kevin Hayden. The Herald is endorsing Hayden in the September 1st Democratic primary over candidate Linda Champion, who is also a serious-minded person, because Hayden is proving he can handle the workload today. We reluctantly need to mention that third candidate for the post, former DA Rachel Rollins. She had her opportunity and disgraced the city and state. She resigned from her post as U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts in 2023 amid a federal ethics probe and allegations that she abused her position. She says other factors were in play, but that's her story. A DOJ probe was partly sparked by her attendance at a Democratic National Committee fundraiser headlined by then-First Lady Jill Biden in July 2022 in potential violation of the Hatch Act, which limits political activities of federal employees, as first reported by the Herald. That and her attempt to influence the DA's race, the DOJ said. Basically, it was a mess. But in politics, second acts are commonplace. So the Herald asked Rollins this month if she would comment on her lavish spending habits from when she held the DA's office. Her answer? Rollins likened the Herald's questions about her use of taxpayer funds to counting ketchup packets. Quote, the Herald currently has several reporters working on a story about Rollins using three packets of ketchup for a hamburger she ate at a middle school picnic, end quote, Rollins said in a written response, and went on, quote, sources close to the picnic indicate attendees were encouraged to only use two packets of ketchup. Stay tuned for more on this breaking story, end quote. The Herald could care less about her condiments, but we were the first to report she spent $33,132 on her P card and on suspicious signatures out of Chelsea this time around that had been flagged on her nomination papers. More politics, more deflection, more insults are not what taxpayers deserve, Is that going to help solve murders? We are not sure if ketchup packets were included in the $33,132, but it is a fact that she used her P card, which taxpayers paid for, at spas in Ireland and Virginia, at posh hotels, and as a regular at the, quote, stylish and elegant, end quote, Ocean Air Seafood Room in the Financial District. The DA for this great city can't obfuscate with crime. Every life matters, and we will quote Champion, who said it best, quote, this is not a game, end quote. Rollins continues to target Hayden and the Herald for reporting truthfully. The city is in the midst of a rash of stabbings and shootings. That is what matters. Yes, a district attorney has an opportunity to be a voice of reason and law and order leader. Hayden is out on the street attempting exactly that almost daily. His P-card spending is a pittance. We asked, he answered. Enough with politics. Suffolk County, Boston, Revere, Chelsea, and Winthrop has nearly 800,000 residents who need a crime fighter, not a spin doctor. We throw our support behind Kevin Hayden for DA. That's the end of the editorial, and I will now read another opinion for today. This one is written by Brian Shortsleeve, and he is a Republican candidate for governor. And his article is entitled, Food Stamp Waste and Fraud Has to Stop, by Brian Shortsleeve. There is a simple principle I've learned in both business and government. People behave differently when they know the boss is paying attention. When there is little oversight, weak verification, and no accountability, waste grows, fraud becomes easier, and taxpayers pay the price. That's exactly what's happening across Massachusetts today. A Fiscal Alliance Foundation report found that Massachusetts leads New England in SNAP spending, accounts for nearly 60% of all SNAP spending in the region, and now faces the possibility of taxpayers paying as much as $300 million annually because of one of the highest payment error rates in the country. The Healey administration's response has been predictable. Hire more employees and hope the problem goes away. That's not leadership. That's treating the symptom instead of fixing the cause. I've seen what actually works. When Governor Charlie Baker asked me to help turn around the MBTA, we inherited an agency plagued by waste, abuse, and a culture that lacked accountability. We didn't solve those problems by hiring more bureaucrats. We solved them by demanding transparency, verifying what was actually happening, auditing operations, and putting real oversight in place. The results spoke for themselves. We uncovered unnecessary spending, eliminated waste, improved financial accountability, put fraudsters in jail, and balanced the budget for the first time in a decade. It hasn't been done since. Similar oversight efforts across state government have shown another important lesson. Once people know someone is paying attention, abuse declines. Accountability changes behavior. That's exactly the philosophy I'll bring to the governor's office. When I say I'll audit every agency, I mean it. When I say we're going to eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse, I mean it. And when it comes to SNAP, that starts with fixing the foundation of the program itself. As governor, I will implement front-end identity and eligibility verification and require the recertification of all participating retailers to ensure taxpayer dollars are going to people and businesses only that qualify under the law. The goal isn't simply to catch fraud after it happens, it's to deter it before it starts. Once fraudsters know there is real oversight and accountability, many won't even attempt to game the system. That's how every well-run business operates. That's how successful government should operate, too. This isn't about taking benefits away from families who legitimately need assistance. Those benefits should absolutely be there. It's about restoring integrity to a system that has lost it. Taxpayers deserve confidence that every dollar is being spent responsibly. Families who truly qualify deserve a program that isn't undermined by fraud and abuse. And Massachusetts deserves a governor who has actually done this before. I've spent my career fixing broken organizations by asking tough questions, demanding accountability, and refusing to accept waste as the cost of doing business. Beacon Hill has forgotten that government works for the taxpayer. As governor, I'll remind them. And that is Brian Shortsleeve's thinking for today. And we will now go on to an article entitled Hub Rates 4 Stars for Immigrants. It's under the subheading of immigration, and Wu touts designation from, quote, welcoming America. Gayla Cawley has written this. Sanctuary Boston was rewarded for rolling out the red carpet for immigrants with a, quote, 4-star certified welcoming designation, end quote, from a group called Welcoming America, making it the first Massachusetts city to earn a certification. Mayor Michelle Wu announced the designation on Monday, saying that it recognizes Boston as a national leader in creating policies, programs, and practices that support immigrant inclusion and belonging. Wu said in a statement, quote, Boston has been shaped by generations of immigrants seeking a better future and working hard to build the city we enjoy today. I'm proud of the work of our Office for Immigrant Advancement, community partners and neighborhood and cultural leaders to expand civic engagement, support our communities, and make Boston a city where everyone belongs, end quote. Wu's office said Boston met the criteria across all 7 areas of the welcoming standard. Welcoming America's roadmap for building inclusive communities, government and community leadership, equitable access, civic engagement, connected communities, education, economic development, and safe communities. Boston's 4-star designation falls short of the highest 5-star welcoming rating for immigrant inclusion. Chicago and San Jose, California also earned 4-star ratings this year. San Francisco received the highest 5-star designation. Daniel Valdez, Deputy Director of Welcoming America, said Boston has been recognized as the first certified welcoming community in Massachusetts. Quote, Boston's work behind this designation, across city government, community organizations, and immigrant residents who shaped it, is what welcoming looks like in practice, end quote, Valdez said in a statement and went on, quote, it's fitting that this comes in America's 250th year, here in the birthplace of the American Revolution, end quote. The Mayor's Office for Immigrant Advancement reviewed city policies, programs, and practices related to immigrant inclusion as part of the certification process. It highlighted Boston's investments in language access, immigrant leadership development, legal services, workforce development, community engagement, and partnerships with organizations serving immigrant residents, Wu's office said. Boston's Chief of Equity and Inclusion, Mariangeli Solis, said in a statement, quote, Boston's strength comes from the people who call the city home, including our immigrant neighbors who contribute to every part of our civic, cultural, and economic life. This designation reflects our continued commitment to creating a city where language access, economic opportunity, and belonging are embedded into how we serve residents, end quote. The designation comes as the mayor is ramping up her battle with federal immigration authorities. Wu on Sunday said she plans to use freedom of information laws to try to figure out who wants to lease parking spaces to ICE Boston in order to prevent the agency's immigration enforcement officers from parking in Boston. Earlier this month, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement posted on a government procurement site that the agency was conducting market research to identify potential parking spaces near existing or planned ICE facilities. ICE said it was looking for 249 contiguous parking spaces in Boston, prompting Wu to quickly issue a statement on the city's opposition to the plan. In an interview with WCVB's On the Record on Sunday, Wu said the market research, quote, seems like an early precursor step, end quote, to future immigration enforcement in the city. She said her administration would reach out to property owners who respond to ICE's leasing request notice. Admitting in the interview that she cannot stop private property owners from leasing to ICE, Wu said her office will file public records requests to learn who is interested in working with the agency so that the city can contact those entities. Quote, we can't block private property owners, end quote, Wu said, but the city can inform them of their opinion on the issues, which is that, quote, this is not the way to make the community safer, end quote. Wu's plan to use public records law to thwart ICE's plans to park in Boston follows other actions she's taken to prevent federal immigration enforcement in the city. The mayor issued an executive order in February. Wu said at the time that the order was in line with the Boston Trust Act, which prevents city police from cooperating with ICE on civil immigration detainers, but still allows for cooperation in certain criminal matters. The Herald has reported that the Boston Police Department ignored all 57 immigration detainer requests issued by federal authorities last year. Boston plans to hold a, quote, welcoming week, end quote, from September 10th to the 19th to celebrate its new certification as a four-star destination for immigrants. That is the end of that. And let me see here what we're going to read next. An article entitled Nick Reiner Fights for Trust Fund Cash. This comes out of California and is subheaded, California's, quote, slayer statute, end quote, blocks payouts, lawyers say. Teresa Brain has written this article. She comes with the NewYorkDailyNews.com. California's, quote, slayer statute, end quote, stands in the way of Nick Reiner and the trust fund his parents set up for him when he was a baby, the professional fiduciary for the fund said in court filings last week. Reiner stands accused of murdering his parents, Hollywood director Rob Reiner and Michelle Singer Reiner, last December, and since June has been seeking to access the $1.6 million fund so he can pay for a private defense lawyer. At the very least, his current attorney has argued in court filings, the 32-year-old should get the portion he was entitled to when he turned 30. The Reiner's younger son pleaded not guilty last week to new charges in the murders after being indicted by a grand jury for, quote, lying in wait, unquote, to ambush them at their family home in Los Angeles's Brentwood neighborhood. He has entered the same plea regarding the murders themselves. Reiner's initial ask came as the trust was changing hands from Paul Kanin to Jody Montgomery, both of whom have opposed the request, according to, quote, People. I assume they mean People magazine. The fiduciaries cited the law, which states that, quote, a person who feloniously and intentionally kills the decedent is not entitled to any property, interest, or benefit under a will of the decedent or a trust created by or for the benefit of the decedent or in which the decedent has an interest, end quote. Further quote, California has enacted no exception permitting a killer's inheritance to be used for criminal defense costs, end quote, wrote Lorianne Wright, a lawyer for professional fiduciary Jody Montgomery, according to the New York Times, which first reported the rejection. Wright also wrote that Reiner had opted out of receiving the approximately $558,000 payout he was eligible for when he turned 30. But he denies giving consent to withhold money and leave it in the trust fund. Reiner's attorney, Anita Wu, argued that the tenant, quote, innocent until proven guilty, end quote, applies to the trust fund issue, which means he's entitled to the money because he's not been convicted. Quote, the Slayer statute requires a determination, not a mere accusation, she countered, according to the New York Times, and she went on, Nick is presumed innocent and has been convicted of nothing. His siblings, Rami and Jake Reiner, would be entitled to the funds instead, Wright maintained, noting that Montgomery has a fiduciary responsibility toward them in addition to Nick, according to the Times. Further, handing over the money now would be a, quote, irreversible, end quote, move, wrote Wright, even if Reiner were to be convicted of the murders after receiving the funds. A hearing on the case is scheduled for Monday, the Times reported. And that ends that one. And we will now start on an article entitled Gaza Ceasefire Still Up in the Air. Kushner and Netanyahu hold marathon talks on the U.S. plan. The Associated Press brings us this through credit. Jerusalem. A marathon meeting on Monday between U.S. negotiator Jared Kushner and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu left the fate of the Gaza ceasefire unclear, with officials signaling moderate optimism but offering no concrete commitment by Israel to the latest U.S. proposed plan. Hamas has already agreed to the proposal. American negotiators appeared to acquiesce to Israeli demands that Hamas disarmament must come before any reconstruction of the devastated Palestinian enclave. They did not publicly signal that Israel had made any commitments to withdraw from the 60% of Gaza that Israeli troops currently occupy. That's a major sticking point in the plan, and one that Hamas had pressed negotiators to compel Israel to fulfill prior to the meeting. The talks came days after Netanyahu rejected the 15-point U.S.-backed roadmap to move the ceasefire deal forward, saying there would be no withdrawal without disarmament. A day earlier, Kushner met for 2 hours with Hamas's leader in Egypt. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair and the director of the U.S.-created Board of Peace, Nikolai Mladenov, that's spelled M-L-A-D-E-N-O-F, Mladenov, I'm saying, were also in the meeting with Netanyahu, according to a source familiar with the plans, and a diplomatic source. Both spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss a closed-door meeting. At stake are the lives of some 2 million Palestinians in Gaza, rebuilding plans, and future control over the territory. In a statement, Netanyahu's office said the talks were, quote, deep and constructive, end quote. Israel and the board agreed to establish 2 working groups, one on the disarmament and demilitarization of Gaza, and another focused on public health issues for Gaza. Israel and the board agreed that the demilitarization, quote, should be prompt and completed before any reconstruction, end quote, the statement said. A Board of Peace official said they also agreed that the demilitarization must include, quote, every weapon, light and heavy, and every tunnel, end quote. The official spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss the closed-door meeting. Quote, backed by Trump, the parties share clear goals, a fully demilitarized and de-radicalized Gaza that poses no threat to Israel and where Gazans can pursue prosperity and dignity peacefully, end quote, the official said. Another Board of Peace official said the meeting was, quote, very productive, end quote, and resulted in agreement on, quote, a path forward, end quote. Quote, the Israelis are going to give this a chance. Now it's up to Hamas to show if it truly intends to comply, said the official, who also spoke on condition of anonymity. Asked if Israel had committed to the U.S. plans for Gaza, a spokesman for Mladenov said it was, quote, a work in progress, end quote. Kushner, who is Trump's son-in-law, met Sunday with Hamas chief Khalil al-Hayya in Cairo on disarmament, according to a regional official and a Hamas official, who both spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to talk to reporters. Officials from mediating countries Egypt, Qatar, and Turkey were also there. The Hamas official said the Hamas leader demanded that Israel halt its attacks on Gaza and withdraw to the so-called, quote, yellow line, dividing the temporary before beginning implementation. The yellow line was never precisely defined. Israeli forces have moved beyond it and now control about 60% of Gaza. In May, Netanyahu said the next step was to move to 70% control, with Israel, quote, tightening the grip, end quote, on Hamas, quote, from every direction, end quote. Several regional powers, including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, issued a statement Sunday condemning Israel's rejection of the roadmap. They said Israel, quote, now bears responsibility for obstructing the efforts to bring peace to Gaza. Other signers included Jordan, Pakistan, Indonesia, and the ceasefire mediators. The foreign minister's statement called on the Board of Peace and the U.S. to take, quote, immediate and concrete measures, end quote, to keep any party from obstructing the plan's implementation. While some in Gaza hope that efforts to implement the roadmap will bring an end to the war sparked by the Hamas-led attack on southern Israel on October 7, 2023, others are skeptical. Mohammed Abu al-Qombuz cast doubt on all talks and visits currently taking place. Quote, a conference here and there, it is all lies. We need a definite solution that would work for everybody, said Abu al-Qombuz, who lives in a Gaza City tent camp, part of the territory's vast displaced population. Under the roadmap, Hamas would hand over weapons to the Palestinian Technocratic Committee meant to oversee daily operations in the territory. The committee has not yet entered Gaza. But Hamas has linked the surrender of its heaviest weapons to the creation of a Palestinian state, and the roadmap entails the creation of a, quote, credible pathway toward achieving Palestinian self-determination and statehood, end quote, something Israel's current government rejects. Until the roadmap is agreed to, other elements of the ceasefire are on hold, including reconstruction and the deployment of international forces to separate Israeli forces from committee-controlled areas. Netanyahu faces a challenging election on October 27th as he tries to hold on to power with a coalition that includes ministers taking a harsh line on Gaza, and it's not clear whether he will take decisive steps on the ceasefire before then. Also coming up is the anniversary of the 2023 attack. And that is the end of the article, and it's also the end of our reading for today. So I wish you a good day, folks. Bye-bye.